seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 060875 Ford Motor Company versus Ezekiel Castillo.
May it please the court, Mr. Morgan will present argument for the petition.
May it please the court. The big question raised by the strange facts of this case is whether concern for protecting the secrecy of jury deliberations and of protecting former jurors from undue harassment should prevail over the interest of protecting the integrity of the jury system itself and of protecting the interests of parties who rely upon the integrity of that system. Here, the facts seriously suggest the possibility that the integrity of that system was compromised in a way that misled Ford into mistakenly entering this settlement agreement. Directly at issue before the court is Ford's thwarted effort to conduct discovery into the odd circumstances surrounding the sending of this misleading note.
Now, what discovery did you not get? I understand you spoke with all the jurors, you hired an investigator, you presented a record of about the discussions with the jurors, and I understand the foreperson was even made available. What further discovery did you need?
Your Honor, we had no formal discovery whatsoever. The foreperson in particular was not made available. The foreperson was the one person who refused to speak with our investigator. We specifically, in particular, we went to the judge and we said, look, these circumstances are peculiar. We found out some of the surrounding circumstances that raised suspicions about the motives of the juror who sent this note, which turns out to have not conveyed an accurate reflection of what the jury was deliberating, or in fact, unwritten instructions should have been deliberating. We asked the judge to either be permitted to take her deposition or to have the judge himself call her in and question about that. He expressed reservations, expressed concerns about the suspicious nature of what had been conveyed, but refused Ford's request to undertake any formal discovery, leaving Ford free to conduct an, quote, informal investigation. But the point Ford makes in this appeal is simply this. This case should be no different from any other with respect to the party's right to conduct discovery. No decision in this state has ever held that the complete denial of discovery is harmless if that party was nonetheless left free to conduct an informal investigation.
Counsel, as I understand it, during deliberations, the presiding juror sent a note to the court that asked, quote, what is the maximum amount that can be awarded, close quote.
That's correct.
It was then discovered that she sent that on her own volition without the consent or vote of the other jurors, correct?
That's correct.
What do you suspect? What is it you're trying to discover?
Well, we strongly suspect that she sent that note in a deliberate effort to mislead the parties into believing the jury had reached the damage questions. And the dramatic effect that that would have in the courtroom is displayed, for example, in the movie The Verdict, in which the conveyance of that question to the courtroom is the climax of the entire movie.
Suppose the jury all agreed to send the letter, to send that note out.
Well, that would be a different circumstance, Your Honor.
Why? The results would be exactly the same.
Well, it might be, but it's much less likely that all of them would agree to send a note that was completely unrelated to the question they were deliberating.
Was the note sent after or before they voted 11-1 for Ford on liability?
It was sent after. The sequence was this, Your Honor. The jury began deliberating on Thursday, and over the course of Thursday, from what we've discovered with subsequent interviews and the informal investigation we were able to conduct, there were two liability questions. The jury very quickly decided 11-1 in favor of Ford in the first liability question, with the one remaining juror voting for the plaintiff being the presiding juror.
Let me just ask you before you get into that, is your opposing counsel going to agree with your assessment of what the evidence is going to show? My understanding is it was a little more equivocal than that among the jurors as to what.
Well, it may be, Your Honor, and that just displays one of the problems you have with doing an informal investigation without the tools of adequate discovery. We don't know exactly what the evidence would show.
I guess what I'm saying, though, is what you're about to answer in response to the previous question is not necessarily the way everyone views the discovery that was had.
Oh, there was no discovery at all had, Your Honor.
But there was some testimony.
The affidavits we obtained and the interviews we obtained are all consistent that the jury had decided the first liability question in favor of Ford, was still deliberating the second liability question, the remainder of Thursday and on Friday, the jury resumed on Tuesday morning when the presiding juror came in, made a little speech about how they should rule for the plaintiff, was unsuccessful, and then while the jury was still deliberating, the second liability question sent out the question about damages. There's no dispute about that. There is some unresolved question about how many of the jurors were aware of her sending that note, how many of them objected to it, but there's no question that the jury had not reached the damage question.
Let me be clear. You think you're entitled to discovery about that, about the internal deliberations of whether to send the note or not?
No, Your Honor. We're entitled. We want to conduct discovery into the circumstances surrounding the sending of this note and why it was sent.
Well, but that's what I'm asking you.
To the extent that it becomes relevant to determine what was occurring in the jury room, yes. We want to investigate that. And remember here, there was no verdict returned. And this note was not part of the discussions.
The internal deliberations are protected much more carefully than the possibility of extrinsic influence on the jury. So you have the rules help you with respect to can you discover whether someone bribed a juror to do something the juror shouldn't have done.
That's right.
But with respect to the internal deliberations, if they were all sitting in there thinking, should we send this note out or not, and some said yes, some said no, and they finally decided one way or the other, you think you're entitled to discovery about that too?
Well, we might be. I'm not sure that was irrelevant, but depending upon what we learned from a more focused discovery of her motives and where the idea originated from.
But if it's all her idea and if it originated inside the jury room and that's all there was, right or wrong, what I don't understand from your earlier answer is, do you want to get into that?
Well, Your Honor, yes. Yes.
And what do we do with Rule 327B?
Juror
may not testify as to any matter or statement occurring during the course of deliberations.
Well, Your Honor, there was no verdict returned here. We are not challenging a verdict.
But there's question. I mean, when she sent out the note, the jury was in deliberations, and you're going to ask her to testify about that matter. That's expressly prohibited by the rule.
Well, Your Honor, if it
is an exception to it,
we say there should be an exception in this case, and there are four possibilities of where the evidence could lead, and we don't know where they would go.
Mr. Morgan, let me ask you this: are you asking us to give you a ruling on what you can or cannot ask down there in discovery, or are you asking for a ruling saying you're entitled to discovery?
We're entitled to discovery.
And as I understand, would that be up to the trial judge to formulate what you could or could not do under the rules of discovery?
That's correct,
Your Honor. Does it make a difference to you why you breached this agreement as to whether or not you're entitled to discovery? What difference does it make why you breached the agreement? You breached the agreement to settle, as I understand. You agreed to that, don't you?
Yes, we entered the agreement there are four possibilities this evidence could lead, and I will tie them into the potential defenses. The first and easiest case, which the plaintiffs have never addressed, I will hasten to say, we do not at present have any evidence to suggest this, but the clearest smoking gun would be if this presiding juror sent that note to provoke a settlement and got that idea outside the jury from someone who could be traced back to the plaintiff's camp.
But let me go back to my question. What difference does it make? As I understand, there's a settlement agreement, Rule 11 settlement agreement. Ford later says, we're not going to comply with that. We're not going to pay it. Is that Ford's position?
Yes.
All right, so now we convert the tort case into a contracts case.
It has been converted into a contract case, Your Honor.
And your position is, it's a contract case. We didn't get any discovery, regardless of the reason, and under a lawsuit like this, we're entitled to some kind of discovery, whatever the trial judge is going to let us do when we go back down there.
That's right, Your Honor.
Have I misstated that somehow?
That's correct. Our position is this is a dispute over a contract in which we were induced to enter the contract by a mistake and perhaps by fraud in the inducement. The circumstances I just described, while we do not have any evidence at present to suggest that, if we conduct discovery and find out the circumstances I've just described turn out to be true, that would be clearly fraud in the inducement. In addition to probably just outright jury tampering, improper outside influence, and jury misconduct.
But let me go back and ask one more time. Are you asking us if we rule in your favor, that is, you're entitled to discovery, are you asking us to set the parameters on this discovery, how far you can go into it, or is that something that's going to be up to the trial court and the lawyers to work out?
No, Your Honor, it would be up to the trial court just as it would be in any other contract
case.
But
didn't the trial judge decide that already?
The trial court decided not to permit any discovery whatsoever, and it's
right.
That ruling.
So we look at that for an abuse of discretion.
Yes.
And as you've said to us, you said to him, well, I want to ask him what went on in the jury room, and he said he looked at Rule 327B and said no. And really, all else, you didn't get to your four reasons, but all else you could ask him is, well, we want to put the jury person down and say, under oath, was there an outside influence?
Well,
and was it he or she?
It was a she.
And she says no. Really, what other discovery could you arguably get if 327B is enforced in your case without an exception?
Well, Your Honor, I would hesitate to speculate about what a trial lawyer who's familiar with the discovery tools used today would permit.
Well, it's true. She may break down and say, oh, yes, you're right, I took a bribe, throw me in jail.
No, that's not.
But assuming she doesn't do that, assuming she says, were you bribed, was outside influence, and she says no, really, what else could you do?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, it's not just a matter of outside influence. I'd like to address that point first. If, in fact, this juror, this would be the weakest possible case that discovery might reveal for us. The weakest possible case would be if the juror decided just to send this note out, a completely innocent curiosity, okay, that nonetheless would enable fits the traditional elements of mutual mistake. More likely, we think, far more likely under the suspicious circumstances presented here, there will be some basis for producing evidence indicating the note was sent to create the impression in the courtroom that the jury had decided liability for the plaintiff and had reached the damage question, but Cortez got that idea on her own. In that case, she would have been using her temporary official position as a member of the judicial branch to operate outside the jury deliberations, outside the process of returning a verdict, in order to manipulate the system to produce the result that she likes.
I agree with that, and maybe she should be thrown in jail, but I'm confused by your mutual mistake. When you get a question from the jury that just says, what's the maximum amount we can award, and then you negotiate a higher settlement, which I understand was what occurred.
Yes.
That's not based on a shared understanding that the jury's going to return that verdict, because the question didn't say they were going to do that.
No, Your Honor.
It's based on an assumption.
It is not based upon a future assumption whatsoever. It's based upon an inaccurate assessment of the current facts. And the current facts on which the parties settled this case was the belief conveyed by that note that the jury had reached the damage questions, which under their instructions they were not supposed to address until the liability questions had been decided for the plaintiff. That was the mistake. Had nothing to do with what the jury might return. There's always the possibility the jury could decide and go back. And that's why the case settled instead of waiting for the jury.
So you don't think jurors sometimes talk about damages before they talk about liability, or in the course of talking about liability?
They may.
So
they may, but that's not what happened here.
That wouldn't mean that they've made up their minds. Nobody could. How could you derive from that note that they were going to return a verdict higher?
We didn't, Your Honor. We didn't. That's the point. We derived from that note that the jury had reached the damage questions, instructions.
That's a logical conclusion. I can understand your position and appreciate your dilemma. If you prevail here, though, where does it stop? Are lawyers going to be able to question every jury in a civil trial where they don't agree with the outcome?
Not at all, Your Honor. First of all, here's the rule that we ask. That where the circumstances suggest the possibility that a presiding juror may have sent a misleading note to the courtroom in order to deceive the parties and thereby provoke a settlement, neither secrecy of the jury deliberations nor her privacy interest as a former juror will prevent discovery that a party who was thereby misled may wish to undertake into the sending of that note. And the unusual facts here permit a very narrow application of that rule. First, that the note was unrelated to any issue the jury was deliberating. Second, it was unrelated to any issue the jury should have been deliberating under their instructions. Third, it was sent solely by the presiding juror. And fourth, there was no verdict ever returned. We are not challenging a verdict.
If, assuming not the worst case, but a bad case, this was just all her idea, and she saw how deliberations were going and wasn't going to come out like she wanted, and so she sent this question to make it come out a different way. Is there any crime involved?
I doubt that, Your Honor. I doubt that. But it would be jury misconduct because...
So there's nothing illegal she did.
Well, it may not be criminal, but I would maintain that it's illegal. In that it is an abuse of her position. A presiding juror who has taken an oath to sit as a temporary official of the court system should not be permitted to manipulate that system to produce the result that she wants that's outside the jury deliberations and outside the process of returning the verdict.
The other jurors did or did not know that the note was being sent?
That's a little unclear. At least some of them say they didn't have any idea it was sent. At least two of them said they knew about it and objected because it was unrelated to the liability question they were deciding.
And did the court convene the jury in the courtroom to answer the question, or the note was simply sent?
It was simply sent back. This is within their usual responses, within the discretion of the jury.
There are four things you said discovery could show. One was fraud and inducement, potentially.
Right.
The second one, I think, was mutual mistake if it was innocently sent
right.
out.
Right.
And I guess there are two more.
There are two more that are somewhere between those two extremes. The second possibility, moving from the most extreme one, which would be fraudulent inducement, would be that the note was sent to mislead and that Cortez got the idea from outside the jury but not from the plaintiffs. And that would be, for us, a defense of mutual mistake, which is an equitable defense, which we believe would be strengthened by the fact that it would be a result of improper outside influence on the jury and jury misconduct, as I described. The next possibility was the note was sent to mislead, but Cortez got her idea on her own, and we contend that that would be a mutual mistake, strengthened by the fact that it was jury misconduct because she was misusing her official position.
Did you try the case, Mr. Morgan?
No, Your Honor, I did not.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please the court, Mr. Hughes will present argument for the respondent.
May I please the court, there's a deeper question here, and it's whether accepting Ford's central thesis will force trial courts to indulge litigants who suffer from buyer's remorse while settling a case during trial. The point that is behind all of our arguments is to honor the existing rules of procedure that give a judge discretion to simplify the proceedings, to enforce a settlement, to terminate litigation, and discourage stalling. And I'd like to talk about one thing that counsel said that I disagree with. There are some other ones, but the one was is that Mrs. Castillo, the presiding juror, refused to talk to them. Their briefs leave that innuendo, but there's not one shred of evidence in the record to support that. The evidence was that at a hearing, the judge told them he had received a complaint from the juror, in which response to Ford's trial lawyer responded, yes, we did have a conversation with her, an interview. Something was said, it might have offended her, we regret it, that it would have been offensive. That was it. They did not comply with Rule 252 or 166A to say, Your Honor, we need discovery from this juror because she won't talk to us. They didn't say anything like that. They didn't even put that in their response to the motion for summary judgment, nor at any subpoint after that. What happened? It was their burden to put that in front of the court. And this court, as I said in the Walmart case,
Why is that? Why should they have asked ahead of time?
Because the rule requires them to state that. The summary judgment rule specifically states if for any reason you're unable to present your evidence, you have to have an affidavit on record to show that and what it is you want to do and why it is you can't get an affidavit or evidence in any other admissible format. And that's the question. Now, I hate to take a moment out to talk about what I hope is a non-issue, and that's the pleading issue. I see in the handouts that there was a question about whether our motion to enforce should be treated as a pleading. All I can say is the Court of Appeals correctly pointed out they waived that in the Court of Appeals, just as they have waived it here. They don't assign it as error. In their reply brief in the Court of Appeals, which is quoted extensively in the Court of Appeals opinion, They specifically said, we are not making any complaint about the adequacy of the pleadings to support a judgment for breach of contract.
Mr. Hughes, assuming that to be the case, you have a tort case, then you have a contract case. You agree with that?
Correct.
All right, and we have a brand new case on the contract.
In one sense, yes, but it's not a brand new case.
Well, it's not a brand new case because you still have the discovery cutoff order from the tort case in position. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes,
so you agreed on that.
Yes.
Right? So if we have now a contract case in the same proceeding with the trial court having cut off discovery, so they go in to ask about discovery on they have to ask about discovery on the contract case. Otherwise, if they just start doing subpoenas and notices, we have a problem with the trial judge maybe being a little upset. You can understand that. So they go in and ask the trial judge to do discovery, but they have a whole different case here, it seems like. How do we reconcile those and the fact that what effectively it seems like we have is a contract case where they're preempted from doing any discovery?
Well, first, they're preempted because they'd already agreed to a cutoff, and so we have certain rules.
It was in the tort case. Now they've breached a contract. You've agreed to that, as I understand.
We certainly do.
Okay. So now we have a breach of contract case. But we have an unusual situation because we have a breach of contract case, new case. You have new pleadings. Your position is new pleadings, breach of contract. But we've preempted our discovery rules by what's gone on before. How do we handle that and make that work out?
Well, we have rules in place. And the first one was the one you addressed just recently in the BP products case, about if you have an agreement concerning discovery, what are the limits the trial court can do to circumvent it? And it was their burden to establish good cause. The second rule, which is in place, has to do with Rule 166, that if you're faced with a summary judgment and you need discovery in order to present admissible evidence, you're supposed to articulate what that evidence is, where it is, and how it's going to change the outcome. And the point is that by the time they got to the point there was a summary judgment, they had interviewed all the jurors. They knew what they were going to say, and they couldn't say anything more. So we have a rule about people who can't explain why they need more discovery to respond to summary judgment. And I point out there is a case that's cited in the brief. I didn't discuss it in great length, the Tenneco case. It's somewhat similar to the Joe case. Only there the plaintiff was summary judgment out on a breach of contract claim. The Tenneco case was a contract over buying. It was an option, a right of first refusal to buy, essentially, I guess, an oil and gas plant. During the discovery period, the plaintiff found out there was a third breach of the contract of which they were completely unaware. Within a day or two after the deposition, the plaintiff files an amended complaint saying there's been a third breach. Within 6 weeks, when, of course, discovery's gone hot and heavy, Tenneco files a motion for summary judgment on the brand-new claim. Once again, the plaintiff responds, I haven't had time. I don't know what all my defenses are. And that motion got overruled. And this court said, I want time to investigate possible defenses is not adequate. The trial court committed no error in saying in denying any continuance to conduct discovery, that was no error. Just looking that you're going to find a defense, that's not enough. You have to be
Counsel,
specific.
I haven't looked at Tenneco recently. It sounds like a material distinction between that case and this one is in Tenneco they were allowed formal discovery.
They were, but
as I understand it, petitioners claim they were allowed no formal discovery. It was all informal. And counsel, as you know, taking a witness statement or giving us, you know, a note from someone who says this is what happened could be an entirely different ballgame from having someone under oath for a deposition or document requests or admissions that are certified as true by counsel and perhaps others when they sign them. Those are different ballgames, aren't they?
No, I don't think so. And let me explain why.
And it was clear that there was a dispute about what happened and whether the contract was really enforceable or was really reached. At least one side argues that. And the judge knew that was ongoing. and then allowed no formal discovery?
Well, I think that gets back then to the Joe case. A party who is
39 joint venture versus
yes.
Joe?
There, they actually did file the affidavit, and the point was is they couldn't point out anything. And, of course, there was the backup statement. The motion was filed so fast. My lawyer was tied up in discovery. They didn't have any chance. And that was rejected. And there's no functional difference between a judge saying, I'm sorry, there's not going to be any formal discovery allowed, and a party whose lawyer simply is so busy that they can't conduct discovery.
Well, the difference in Joe, which I'm pretty familiar with, is
yes.
that we said that none of the discovery that they sought would have changed any of the outcome here. That's not the argument being made in this case.
Yes, but that was not exactly the factual circumstances. But in Tenneco, the argument was raised is we haven't had enough time to determine if we have potential defenses that we haven't learned of yet. And the court said that's not enough. You have to be specific, which is then why you were able in Joe to get to the point of, okay, you have to file an affidavit. You just can't say, maybe I have issues to raise. You have to be specific, and if you don't, then there's no abuse of discretion.
Counsel, do you think that there is discovery that the trial court could have carved out and targeted that would have been permissible even under Rule 327B?
I think if they had come in with actual proof of outside influence, as it is classically understood, then the court may have been able to lift it. But then you run into the problem under Rule 166 and 252. They have to articulate what that evidence is to avoid summary judgment.
Okay. To assume that they meet as what you believe to be the requirements in order to obtain the discovery, there's discovery that could have been taken that would have been consistent with 327B, correct?
If they could make a showing of outside influence. But the problem is, they, even as the Court of Appeals said, their inability to conduct formal discovery did not obstruct them from finding out what these people had to say and reporting it to the court if they thought it would help them. The problem is not that they couldn't get the witnesses to talk to them. The problem is that when the witnesses didn't have anything to say that helped them, or they didn't want to report to the court what they were being told.
So there were 10 affidavits that were...
No.
Well, they're talked about. What do you want to say about the affidavits?
There were only four affidavits. There were 10 unsworn, what we call Q&As. That is, somebody just types up what is being said. Nobody's under oath. The 10 Q&As were stricken because they were unsworn, and they don't complain about that ruling. That ruling is not assigned as error. However, what the trial court did was, you've got to understand the procedural background, they first came in after agreeing to pay on the record, saying, oh, yeah, we're going to pay. They then come back and just file a garden variety motion to set aside the agreement, and they attach those statements. The trial court's ruling on their motion was, I'm going to exclude the Q&As because they're unsworn, but I've read them anyway. And if I didn't exclude them based on those, I find no outside influence. They don't complain about that ruling. They do not complain about the judge's express ruling on their motion saying, I don't find any outside influence. And that motion they presented without claiming they needed any additional discovery to make their point.
And as to the four affidavits?
Those were excluded under Rule 327 and 606. No, I will say this. The first time they asked for discovery, right after the jury was discharged, the judge denied the objection, admitted the affidavits, read them, and said, they don't prove outside influence. Go talk to the jurors and bring me more evidence. That was the judge's first ruling.
Mr. Hughes?
Yes.
Let's assume there was no outside influence, but the scenario that Mr. Morgan outlined is what happened or could happen. That is to say, a presiding juror, without discussing the matter with the rest of the jurors, just takes it upon him or herself to go out and try to influence the proceeding in a manner such as this. What should this court's response be to that?
Well, I think it's already been mentioned earlier. A court may have inherent power, perhaps to contempt power to sanction a juror who is somehow obstructing the proceedings. But that doesn't amount to grounds to rescind a contract. That instead has to be fit into one of the recognized equitable reasons. And the only one they have articulated is mutual mistake. That won't fly. Mutual mistake, number one, requires a mistake about a fact. Now, the only thing that was going to drive Ford to go up or down to settle now or settle later was their estimation of, number one, what was the verdict likely to be? Number two, how is the trial judge going to rule on all their post-verdict motions? And then, of course, what's going to happen in the Court of Appeals if we get a bad judgment? All those things are in the future. The fact that they're on one question now, every trial lawyer knows. Every trial lawyer knows jurors talk about a lot of things as they go through. They may talk about damages before they finish talk about liability. They may change their minds while they're being polled in the jury box.
Right, but going back to the example, how would we find out that that's what occurred without some form of discovery?
Well, once again, the judge in this case said, you can talk to the jurors, bring me evidence of misconduct. But then the question is, where, if you got affidavits from the jurors, does it lead? Juror misconduct is not a grounds to set aside a settlement agreement. You have to put it in one of the standard categories.
So the presiding juror is somehow found to have acted ultra vires, to say, and causing this settlement that otherwise would not have occurred to occur. And so we can discipline somehow that juror, but it doesn't do anything to set aside the fraudulently induced, if that's what it was,
well,
agreement.
That's the point. It's not fraud, and it's not mutual mistake.
It does look unfair, though.
Well, Your Honor, this court has already held in the cases I've cited in the...
Wouldn't you concede, I mean, the parties, according to the briefs, the parties were talking of settlement in the $1 million, upper $1 million range. They got this question and it settled for $3 million. And it turns out that the jury wasn't even close to thinking about what's the maximum amount of damages we could award. So you would concede it looks unfair. Your client has gotten a windfall.
Well, no. There's a factual predicate here we dispute. Their recitation of the settlement negotiations was disputed. That just came from the unsworn argument of counsel in support of a motion. Our lawyer disputed that, said, no, that was not the state of negotiations. Now, I understand the impact of the note, but the problem...
What did he say it was?
He said that they're completely wrong and that all Ford said was, if a note comes out from the jury, all deals are off.
Well, Mr. Hughes, it seems like that would almost make these lawyers witnesses in a mutual mistake of fact question on a breach of contract. It seems like the further we go into this, the more and the deeper we get as to why discovery might be necessary in the breach of contract case.
Well,
because what's in the lawyers' minds, truly, I mean, that's what determines the mutual mistake, it seems like. Either they did or did not both act on the same assumption, or it seems like we might just be getting deeper into it.
Well, we're getting... The breach of contract case, our case is made. The question is their defense. Do they have mutual mistake or as they say, fraud? This court has already said, and I understand where the court's going. What I'm saying is we have to get back to what is the issue that is the defense to get them out for breach of contract. This court and other courts have already said if a third party makes a false statement of fact to you and that misleads you into entering into the agreement, that is not fraud. It's only fraud if the defendant participates in it. Now, they've disclaimed that in the trial court. Mutual mistake is not a problem because the court, this court and the restatement all take the position that the mistake of fact that will support rescission has to go to the ability to perform the agreement, not the inducement to enter into it. That's why people who enter into construction contracts and then suddenly find out it's going to be more expensive or difficult to perform don't have mutual mistake as a defense. Mutual mistake is not key on what induced you or caused you to enter into the agreement. It has to do with whether you can perform the agreement, and you can't perform it because you made a mistake of fact that about something that would help you about how to perform the agreement. That's not it. They're talking here about a mistake that goes to their inducement. Now, all I can say at this point is the court would, and I hesitate to put it this bluntly, the court would have to create a new ground, equitable reason to set aside. And I has, and before the court,
well, we should be. If this happened in a lot of cases, it'd be a big problem.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. In
let me be, if this if people got the understanding, they could privately send out a note that would manipulate a settlement. A lot of jurors might do it. And how would we stop that when our rule says you can't ask the jurors about what anybody did in the jury room?
Well, Your Honor, I really don't. Let me put it this way. I think if you look from the jury instruction, the instructions the jury are getting, I think it'd be, you'd have a hard time from the point of view of a layperson figuring out that what you say in your notes is going to go to the attorneys. If you look at the standard instructions, they just say your notes go into the judge. You don't, I mean, we all know.
But
that,
is there an instruction? I can't find one in 226A that says the juror, the only notes can be sent out have to be from the whole jury rather than.
There isn't. There isn't.
But really, the lady didn't even violate any instruction or rule.
No, and that's the point. There is no instruction that says they have to get approval. There was a dispute about how they would go about sending out notes. And
but counsel, the presumption is and the understanding is that notes from the jury come from the jury, not from a juror acting privately. Surely you understand that. There's several former trial judges up here who've taken hundreds of verdicts. Any note that comes out of that jury room, everybody in the courtroom presumes comes from the jury, not from an individual juror acting privately with an agenda, if that was the case.
Well, Your Honor, number one, as we said, I don't think the jury can hold other jurors in communicado. And I think it was indicated in the Boyette case that I cited in that brief that if the presiding juror or even a majority of jurors decide, I'm sorry, that note's going out no matter how much, some individual juror wants it, that's too bad.
But that's still consideration of an action by the entire jury, not a note sent out without, if that was the case here, the other jurors knowing what was going on.
Well, first, one of the unstorned statements was excluded.
The time's about out. Let me ask you a question. If during deliberations the presiding juror sent out a note that said, what happens if we reach zero on damages? Would that have affected your conduct in consideration of the settlement?
I think
would that
it
have
might
bothered you? Is that kind of thing, whether it comes from the plaintiff or the defendant side, when it seems to be and may be an agenda by an individual, if that's the case here, that's causing us a lot of concern? We don't want to undermine the integrity of the process, but wouldn't that concern you if that question came out?
Your Honor, I've actually seen questions come out that we've already answered, all the liability questions, no, et cetera. And pretty much it puts an end to all further discussions if there have been at that point.
If it's a statement from the jury, not an individual acting, if they are, with an agenda, those are different things.
Your Honor, I think if that were the case, the court has power to deal with that directly with the juror. But that does not that is not a ground to start setting aside settlement agreements.
So it would concern you, my hypothetical. The question is, what, if anything, should happen in response?
And as I said, the court has the inherent power to deal with that, but I don't think that fits with any of the traditional equitable grounds to set aside settlement agreements. And I think one of the reasons, again, is a lot goes into the decision about to settle besides just one jury note. Lawyers think about all their trial motions and pretrial motions and all of that. And so just to say, based on this one note and this one juror's notions, we're going to let you scuttle a settlement that because you misread the jury.
Real quick, you said there was a dispute as to how the jury would submit
notes. What do you mean?
I think if you'll look at the affidavits, they're not entirely clear that there was any, the jurors had any fixed practice. And once again, if you can look at the 10 Q&As, which were excluded and which they don't complain, but if you were, I think you will find that some jurors said the process was we would talk about it. Some of them would say, she would say, well, I'm going to send this out, anybody object? And if there were no objections, it didn't make any difference if you agreed. I mean, there was no fixed procedure, but there was one juror who said, yeah, I knew this note was going out, and I had no objection to it. Then, unless there are any further questions, the red light. Thank you. We request you affirm.
This certainly is a bizarre set of facts, and we share Justice Brister's concern that it not be one that occur very often. There don't seem to be any reported decisions, in this state, and neither side seems to have been able to find one anywhere in the country that have dealt with this circumstance. But the position that the plaintiffs have taken in response is simply untenable. Their position, simply stated, is that no evidence that Ford could possibly obtain through the course of formal discovery could be relevant to any defense it might assert to enforcement of this settlement agreement, and that just cannot
be. Did you specifically seek to take the deposition of the presiding juror before the trial court?
Yes.
You formally requested her deposition?
Well, I don't know if it was formally. It was never noticed or anything. We went to the judge at the hearing that's cited in our briefs and said, Your Honor, you know, this is what we found out about the circumstances we have. We would ask, given the sensitivity of the area in which we're starting to tread, we would ask the court for permission to either take her deposition or ask the court to bring her in and question her about this, because this looks suspicious to us. And the judge said no. There was a subsequent time when the request for formal discovery was included in part of the arguments in the papers. But yes, we did ask for that. Now, I'm not saying.
I disagree with your opposing counsel's statement that you did not specifically request discovery as to her.
Yes. There's no question. That was precisely the focus of the discovery.
If a judge granted that, wouldn't you be violating Rule 327B?
No, Your Honor, he would not be, because that deals. Well, he construed that to be, we were not seeking to overturn a verdict, and that deals with a challenge to a verdict. No verdict was ever even reached here. And furthermore, even that rule provides an exception for outside influence. And there was a reason here.
It seems to me that lawyers are assessing these kinds of things all the time. Say you have a summary judgment hearing, and you're standing out in the hallway, and you're saying, well, you know, can we settle? I don't know. And you go in. Well, it's time to go in the hearing. So you go in the hearing, and you argue to the judge, and the judge gets to the end, and he says, you know, I don't know. I think the movement has a pretty strong argument here, but I it's pretty convincing, but I need to think about it. Don't you go back out in the hallway and discuss settlement differently than when you went in? And maybe the judge thinks that. Maybe he's just trying to provoke a settlement. Maybe he honestly changes his mind later on. That's just something for counsel to assess.
Your Honor, and we may have, and it's true on the one hand that we have assumed the risk of interpreting the intent or these facts behind this note in one sense. But the one thing that we absolutely never assumed was the risk of fraudulent inducement. That is obviously the easiest case here. That would be the smoking gun. But we don't know. And judges are not jurors. Jurors are, you know, they take an oath to follow their instructions, to follow the procedures. They're part of a group. They're supposed to act as a group. And the reason that they're impaneled is to go through the process of deliberating to reach a verdict that awards one side or another a judgment. Here, there's reason to suspect that we had one juror manipulating her official position to produce a result that's completely outside the jury deliberations, completely outside returning the verdict. And that's an abuse of her position, quite simply. And we have a right to investigate.
There's no evidence of what she did the day off except take her son to the emergency room?
No, there's not. And to briefly address counsel's position, even if we do not show fraudulent inducement, which obviously, again, will be the smoking gun, the facts here that we believe will be developed would easily fit within the traditional elements of mutual mistake, which requires a reasonable mistake of fact held mutually by the parties that materially affects the agreed upon exchange. And that, we think, would fit here. It is an equitable remedy, which considers surrounding circumstances, which would include, we contend, the misconduct of a juror who's deliberately manipulating her official position in a way that's not contemplated by the law. We believe that this verdict, this judgment, should be reversed, remanded, so that Ford can undertake the discovery necessary to find out what truly happened.
Let me just clarify one point. To do that, we would have to say that the trial court abused its discretion in denying discovery as to the presiding juror.
No, Your Honor, I would not narrow it that it abused its discretion in denying us discovery into the circumstances surrounding the sending of this note by which Ford was misled in entering the settlement agreement, relevant to its potential defenses of fraudulent inducement, mutual mistake.
But I guess that's where I get confused, because what difference does it make what the other jurors would say? Apparently you want to know what induced her to see if there was fraudulent inducement. Well, so she's really the only one.
Well, Your Honor, what the other jurors would say may reveal what her intents were. I mean, as the argument today has displayed, there is some disagreement among the parties now about what occurred, what the posture was at the time she sent that note, whether any other jurors agreed to its sending, whether and to what extent other jurors objected, and what comments or remarks she made to them about her intent in sending the note. So we're not willing to say no. We'll just depose her, and she says no, it was innocent, and that's
so
it.
So you'd want us to say the trial court abused its discretion in not allowing discovery of the jurors and the presiding juror, all the jurors.
Well, broader than that, discovery into our affirmative defenses of mutual mistake and fraudulent inducement
as
related.
But who else would that be?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. If the evidence leads to someone outside the jury, we're going to want to follow that.
Was the movie that raised that specter The Runaway Jury by the Grisham book rather than The Verdict?
No, it was The Verdict. Paul Newman.
That was outside influence. The movie The Verdict, my time is up. But in the I reviewed this recently so I can relate. In The Verdict, the climactic scene is when the jury actually returns in that scene. The foreman stands up and says, we've decided to rule
in favor.
I think
we've heard enough.
All right.
the cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All right.